Conciliums with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this. Can't you split that, or are you going to just put it down as one?
No, I can always split it.
Are you recording now?
I don't want to tell you.
Okay. I can usually tell because the clock's going. It means you're not. You haven't hit the start button yet. So
look at that.
Oh, he has hit the start, so I can't talk about personal issues anymore.
You can talk about them, but I'll just put them on the podcast. We could talk about personal issues. There's no reason why this shouldn't be therapy for both of us at some point or another.
Well, I will say this, that stand-up comedy is therapy. Any comedian will agree that it is therapy. And you don't have to worry about whether or not it's covered by your insurance.
And from my time in college dating, I've learned that you can feel a lot better if you scream your problems at a bunch of people.
Yeah, it's good.
Especially if they're drunk.
And I don't have to pay, you know, $150 an hour or more for them to listen.
Did you have... Did you have a lot of ups and downs, say, relationship-wise in college?
Nah, not really. I kind of dated the same woman for most of that time.
I had lots of ups and downs.
Okay.
And I feel sometimes like all I did was tell people about how the last one didn't work.
Okay.
I'm just saying. I feel like I just went.
But if the last one ended, by definition, it doesn't work.
Well, it didn't work, but.
But you yammered about it a lot.
I yammered. And it seems like you should be able to just say, like now, right? I've been married for 4 years. I've been married 4 years, seeing the woman for six. And if this ended, I think it would be worth all of the pain and trauma that I pretended my year-long relationships required in college.
I have no idea what you just said.
Well, you should use algebra to figure it out.
What, I need the transitive property to figure out what you just said?
Hamlet, in love with the old man's daughter, the old man thinks.
The old man thinks that Hamlet's in love with his daughter?
Yeah, the old man thinks he's in love with his daughter. Oh, we're out of our depth. No. Hamlet in love with the old man. Anyway, so I pretended, in retrospect, I pretended that the heartbreak that I was experiencing when I broke up with college girlfriends was as bad as my heartbreak would be now if my marriage ended.
And why did you do that? Why were you so melodramatic?
I don't know. Might have been the drugs. Might have been the depression. Might have been boredom.
Okay. But sometimes people just like to yammer about stuff, right? You think about what lunchtime conversation is. And here's an interesting, insightful comment. People think that if you're a scientist or an applied scientist, say an engineer, that you're more logical in every aspect of your life.
And
you are.
A chemical engineer?
Well, any kind of engineer, any kind of
scientist. A biomolecular and chemical engineer?
A biostatistician, whoever you are very systematic, methodical in your work. You must be. That is the nature of your work. But in your personal life, sometimes you are very systematic and methodical as well. I will admit once we don't do it anymore because we're sort of all over the country now. But years ago, my family, we used to draw names for Christmas gifts, right? It's a very common thing, right? I have seven siblings, so there's eight of us plus my mom.
So yeah, you don't want everybody to buy
So you pick everyone's name. And, you know, I buy for my sister Ann this year and my brother Bill buys for me. You know, that kind of thing. It's pretty silly. So most people take, you know, a few strips of paper, write names on them and pull them out of a hat. I actually wrote an application, I don't know whether it was Excel in Visual Basic or MATLAB or something like that, to use a Donald Knuth linear congruential random number generator to randomly pick these things.
Let's go back for a second, because I think maybe you buried the lead here.
I did, and the lead is that we're not always that systematic in our personal lives, the emotional component.
Do people think that scientists are Spock?
I don't know. Maybe some people do.
I've noticed. I don't like the Big Bang Theory.
Blasphemy.
Okay,
blasphemy,
good,
I say.
Good. So we'll get the Big Bang Theory out of the way right here. Right here and now in this episode of Consilience with
Big
Pete
Bang
and Charlie.
Theory.
Have you noticed that the Big Bang Theory is not funny?
I think it's hilarious, man.
I've never enjoyed the jokes. I've never enjoyed the jokes or the situations. I like some of the stunt casting. Some of the awkward humor has made me laugh. But mostly, I feel like it's really bland. And I don't think you're bland, Pete. I love you. But I think the show is bland.
Okay.
And I feel like the attempt to make these characters uber smart and in some way emotionally stunted or damaged is a terrible disservice.
I will agree with you on that. It is a disservice, and it does reinforce a stereotype that we're trying to get rid of.
Yeah. And I don't have an example.
But that's what makes it so funny.
I had no idea we were going to talk about the Big Bang Theory, so I don't have an example. But I will just describe what I remember recently.
Okay.
The main character gets a little drunk, and he's talking about his girlfriend, and he says something along the lines of...
this is probably Leonard. Leonard, who's dating Penny. Right?
Mathematically, my emotions are such that I should not be affected in this way. Like, he makes this sort of overly...
He was trying to be logical.
Right. But I don't think people try to be logical
that way. Don't.
That's what I'm saying.
They
is
don't.
That the it's,
most
it's
logical
a silly stereotype.
Scientist is also... illogical in their emotions. That's exactly what I'm saying. You know, people just assume that, well, he's got a PhD. I bet he doesn't leave skid marks on his underwear. And
Pete, are you telling us something a little too...
No, I don't think I have for a while. I'm just saying...
Vulnerable about
that,
yourself.
You know, if you're a scientist or engineer, you know, you got better things to do than wipe that fourth time. That's all I'm saying. You got stuff to do. No, skid marks are probably a bad example. But we're illogical.
Yeah, that engineer there probably doesn't have to...
Yeah, we get hurt, we get wounded,
insecure.
We pout, we feel insecure.
They can just do an equation to figure out what they should do, right? Wasn't that thing?
Right. Equations will not do that for you. But...
did I talk about this last time, the book How to Stay Sane?
Yeah, you did.
That's
obviously
one of
your favorite books.
Yeah. I've been trying to read it.
But considering you read at a third grade level, it's been taking you up.
And it's not helping yet. So,
well, this is the origin of a fairly recent concept, maybe only over the last decade, of EQ. Emotional quotient. EQ is very important. Your ability to be human, recognize and empathize with human characteristics in others is very important. And in fact, we had some industrial visitors in today, and I'm not going to mention them.
Were they made of steel?
No. They're actually sponsoring our senior design project. Very nice folks. And one of them is an alumnus of this fine institution, Georgia Tech, who said that and he simply confirmed what other people have told me as well, that when you do an interview, you've already passed the first hurdle. You've got a decent GPA, decent background, decent experience from companies and universities that are good. And they're interested in hiring you. What keeps you from getting hired are if, for example, you show no technical acumen whatsoever and they're thinking, whoa, how did they give this guy a degree? That's pretty rare, though. But a big part of it is, can you talk to other human beings? Because in the modern era, makes me sound highfalutin.
Starting when? When does modern era start?
You know, probably just the last few decades.
I think actually Shakespeare is credited with beginning modernism.
Okay, but I'm going to say the last few decades.
Okay.
Because that's the horizon of my experience. You know, you could put the geeks in a back room and say, well, how do I know your geeks are good? Well, here, take a look. And you open it, and there's a guy with tape on his glasses, and they're like, well, he's geeky. He must be good. Even those guys have to talk to customers, to marketing people, to
I thought you were going to say even those guys have to talk to girls.
No, because now some of those guys are girls. I hate to break it to you. I know female
you
versions of Sheldon.
I'm very happy.
Right. There are female versions of Sheldon and Leonard. And on that show, that would be...
This is Big Bang Theory that you're talking about.
Big Bang Theory. Yeah, so your emotional quotient is very important. It won't impact your ability to do really good science or engineering, but it will impact your ability to explain why we should give a crap about it to the people that need to know. And sometimes that's the CEO of the company. And maybe the CEO of the company, you know, has a graduate degree in science or engineering. So they're no dummy, but you have to make it relevant.
Do you know anybody who has I mean, this is a joke, but do you know anybody who has a zero EQ? Do you know anybody out there who just doesn't
have the... Yes, I've met a few.
Did you work with them? And we're not trying to identify them now. What is that like?
One would associate zero EQ to someone with severe ADHD, Asperger's
zero
syndrome.
Zero is a bad.
Yeah.
Example.
But let's put that's a pathology that we can measure. So let's put that out of the way. People that don't have one of these known pathologies that just is close to zero, right? They're asymptotically approaching zero, and
did you just call them an ass?
No, asymptotically. That means they're gradually approaching. And see, that's another thing.
Asymptote? What?
Asymptote. Asymp, there's a P in it. It's, you know, this is why you don't like the Big Bang Theory and I do. My friend Joe Shork, who's teaching along with Matthew Ralph and I, the senior design course, made a very funny joke today. And it's a joke that I said, Joe, I said, you know, I got some gigs coming up. You just wrote a joke for me. And that it's only a joke that geeks would get. And that is that, I said, well, professors do is they write the left-hand side of differential equations, and it's the graduate student that let me see if I get this right, that writes the right-hand side. And if you ever written a differential equation, we usually write, you know, the change in something with something, like, you know, the change in temperature with time equals, it's the right-hand side that's complicated. And he dumped it on the TA saying, look, you guys write the right-hand side.
So essentially the professor says, we're going to find this out. You do that.
Yeah, exactly. But by putting it in that inside joke format of I write the left-hand side, you write the right-hand side, we laughed at that, but only geeks would laugh at that. And let me give you a good example from the Big Bang Theory. And in fact, they just showed the rerun recently of when their apartment got broken in.
There's no way that this is going to be played anytime around.
Yeah, that's okay. No, okay. But this is a rerun, so that means this was first
cast
last year.
So our listeners could totally go and track this one down.
Yeah, and it's the episode where Sheldon and Leonard's apartment got broken into.
Okay.
And, you know, they felt so violated, and they go in, and, you know, the laptops are gone, the TV's gone, Sheldon's freaking out, and he runs back in his room, and he goes, oh, thank God, my comic books are here. So, again, it's perceived value, so he's kind of missing it. His comic book collection is more important than his computer. And that's okay. To him, it is. But then they finally got new computers. Their insurance company paid for this stuff, and he got a new computer, and I don't know what it was. So this was back when Windows 7 might have been new.
oh, so long ago.
Well, apparently he either had Windows XP or Unix or Linux or something on his machine. And Sheldon was sitting there typing going, you know, this new operating system, whatever it was, is very user-friendly. I don't like it. And we laugh at that because true geeks do two things. One, they like more control, so they're willing to give up operability and user-friendliness to have more control over doing exactly what they want. And then true geeks brag about that. They're like, oh, yeah, I do everything in binary, dude. You know,
yeah, when I hung out with Linux guys, and they were all guys at the time, I noticed,
that's true.
Yeah, I mean, this was a while back. I noticed that they were very happy about that they had to mount the CD drive. Before they,
oh yeah. So back when you hung out with Linux guys, is when I hung out with Linux guys. You know, this Red Hat Linux that has
2002 to 2006.
Well, it was even before that. There was no graphical user interface. It was all command line, and you'd say mount dash something. You'd give it slash dev slash something. That's how you did it.
Yeah. And I told someone recently, I was like, I just don't want to type that anymore. I don't want to type.
Yeah.
What device I want to use anymore. I'm done with that.
Yeah, I do like graphical user interfaces. I like Windows 7. I haven't used Windows 8 yet, though.
But people talk about stick shifts. You know, if you drive a car with a stick shift, you have more control over the way the engine works.
Right, exactly how you accelerate.
Yeah, they compare Linux to the stick shift versus the automatic transmission.
I agree.
And, you know, there's some... Is there an argument for that?
And the argument is, if you have a high-performance vehicle over which you want complete control of the engine torque to accelerate as rapidly as possible and decelerate as rapidly as possible, if you drive a Lotus, you want a stick shift.
Yeah, you can't leave it up to...
But if you drive a Toyota minivan like I do, that's, by the way, sandalwood brown, right? The car I drive is a Hyundai Elantra, and it's got a bumper sticker... on it that says, my other car is a brown minivan. you know, if you're driving that to get the kids to and from, you know, you don't really need a stick shift. You know, maybe mileage is an issue. But let's face it, if you got kids and you're driving them in the minivan, and you're going to be there soon, pal.
Yeah, yeah. I have something
you
to say.
You need
about this.
The extra hand to swat your son in the back or to balance your big gulps, your Red Bull to keep from falling asleep and steering your car into a bridge abutment. So,
you know,
right.
We got on this because I was talking about how I feel very insecure recently. I feel like I'm not.
We all feel insecure.
Well,
we all feel insecure.
Yeah, but I feel really insecure right
now.
And
why would that be, Charlie?
I'm not sure. I think it has something to do with my new child, new baby. How do you even say that?
New child's okay.
New child, okay. See, I can't even talk. The sleep deprivation thing, you know, it's special.
Right.
When it's a kid, you don't feel like I'm so tired. You just say things like, oh, yeah, we'll put gas in it after it runs out. It'll be fine. Or something like that. I just made that up. I didn't
putting gas in a baby, bad idea.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's right. Although they seem to have a lot.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. That's the kind I was referring to.
So I feel, well, there you go. See, I can't even understand jokes. I just feel like I'm missing little things all the time. I can't remember why I started this. Emotion, I feel insecure. Kids, oh, right. Okay. My mindset is such that if I had to think about shifting gears,
mm-hmm.
I would probably screw it up, just in general. I think it has to do with having the kids. It has to do with my attention being divided. My emotional attention is very much divided or perhaps even completely directed, completely differently directed
right.
than it used to be. Wow, I can't talk. I don't know why.
Well, I think we're just going to put you down right now. Just lethal injection, put you out of your misery.
I was told that this sort of disruption of mental processes and peaks about mm-hmm. 5 months.
So it peaks at 5 months
and then it sort of fixes itself, yeah.
Yeah, that may be true.
You know, the kid eventually learns to dress and walk.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not in that order.
Right. Right. All right. So we've established that EQ is just as important as IQ, and that EQ is relevant for geeks as well.
And if someone didn't hear last time, I went on a long tangent about that book, How to Stay Sane, and in it is the argument that without emotion, you can't make a decision. That even a completely logical person without a little bit of emotion won't be able to make a decision, and that was discovered in clinical tests of people whose emotional centers were damaged.
But I would say that's only true of complex decisions, right? A simple decision. You know, you have two choices for your cable TV provider, and one is 30% more expensive, and it offers no, you know, tangible better services. You can make that. But most decisions are made with incomplete information.
I didn't read this study, so I don't know.
Yeah, most decisions are made with incomplete information. So
I read a summation of the study.
Yeah, you need to take all the data, form sort of an amalgam in your mind, and to borrow a phrase from Randy Olson, you know, go with your gut, go with your heart sometimes. Make a guess. Be willing to say, I have no idea. I'm going to go with my gut. I'm going to choose this one. If I'm wrong, you know, maybe I can change after 6 months.
A lot of people talk about failure being a very powerful and productive thing.
Yeah, it's an important learning tool as well. In fact, some of the most brilliant people fail because they cannot commit to a decision. They're not willing to make a mistake and say, look, I'm not really sure. I'm going to guess this and see where we go. And my daughter has corroborated that. She said she, in her high school, she knows some really brilliant people who, in the end, won't turn in an assignment because they couldn't decide how to finally tweak it at the end.
Couldn't make it perfect.
Couldn't make it perfect, yeah.
Perfect is the enemy of the good.
Yeah, exactly. It's the enemy of productivity. That's certainly the case. So a little bit of EQ. And I think, don't you think everyone's EQ improves with age?
Yeah, and that was what I was going to go with on the failure thing. I mean, do you feel like we appreciate failure more and more as we fail more and more and are able to recognize that we failed more and more?
Yes. I think we realize that failure is not the end of everything, that you can survive, move on, learn from it. We then come to a point in our lives when we realize we're a total loser and it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, exactly. This year I've come to the realization that I'm basically a loser, and that is kind of okay.
I think we're all losers.
Second, well, there's a couple winners out there, clearly.
And who might those be?
George Clooney might be a winner.
Is he a winner?
I think George Clooney's first place, yeah. George Bush is a bit of a winner.
Which one? Herbert Walker or W?
Sure, both of them. Why not? Those guys walked away from the White House.
But look, probably all three of those guys are sitting at home thinking, I'm so insecure, I wish I was like Charlie Bennett. I don't know. I take
a certain amount of strength from that Beckett quote about, you know, try again, fail better, right?
Well, yeah, I would use, a guy in my field who once said, he was giving a talk. This is Jeff Skolnick, actually, and he does molecular simulation, similar stuff to what I do. And someone accused him of cheating in his model. He said, of course I'm cheating. It's a model. But the question is, am I cheating less this year than I am last year? That's really it.
Did he get away with that? It sounds like someone would use that as an admission of guilt, that they would use that to crowbar their way into a model and say, see, he said he was cheating.
But most models and theories in science and engineering are approximations. So what he's saying is, am I making less approximations or more reasonable approximations this year as compared to last year? That's all it's saying. And if your model, with all its faults and all its shortcomings and approximations, can provide insight in how to design and build things better, then it's useful. That's it. So really, it's this whole thing of good enough. And as bad as I'm doing, I am trying the best I can.
Do you think we can make a comparison of models like predictive models of natural
phenomenon.
Thank you. Phenomena.
Phenomena. It would be plural.
Phenomena.
Grammar Nazi.
Do, 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 do.
Phenomena.
Or,
do, 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 do.
Oh, man. We're going to have to pay licensing fees and to bleep all that. Can we take that model of models?
Okay.
And compare it.
Would that be a meta model?
Sure. Yeah.
I love that word meta. We should do a whole show on the word meta.
We should do a show about shows?
We should do a meta show. Yes. There you go.
I'm going to get to the end of this thought.
Indeed you will.
And you're going to hate it.
Okay. No, I won't.
Can we compare predictive...
I'm a loser. I don't give a crap.
Predictive models of natural phenomena with artwork.
Now you're talking crazy.
No, think of it this
way. You'll have to explain this.
I will.
And I think you'll have to pee in a cup at the end of the show. That's what you're going to have to do.
Don't I always?
it's court mandated, ladies and gentlemen.
All right, so here we go. What's his name? Shork? Joe? What? What was his name? Your buddy?
Which guy?
With the cheater? The cheater buddy.
Jeff Skolnick.
Jeff Skolnick.
Well, he's not really my buddy, but I know him.
This fella?
Yeah.
So Jeff says, of course I'm cheating. The question is, am I cheating less? Meaning he probably tried to make that model before, right? And with more data, he's able to make a more accurate predictor, right?
Yes.
Now imagine someone who is writing novels about adulterous married couples.
Okay.
Let's say it's John Updike, who seemed to write about adultery a lot.
Right. And what did Updike write? What was
he wrote The Witches of Eastwick, Run, Rabbit, Run. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't remember any of the other titles now. Rabbit is Rich was one of his books.
I like The Witches of Eastwick.
Did you see the movie?
I saw the movie.
I love the movie. The book is nothing like the movie.
Oh, okay.
The movie was good.
Okay, so he writes about adultery.
Oh, who's your favorite writer?
I'm going to embarrass myself.
It's cool.
Well, I've probably read more of his books than anyone else, and I'll tell you why I like him. It's Tom Clancy.
Okay.
He writes military thrillers. Yeah. I like him because he's a geek.
Right.
He puts in a lot of geeky details, like the two crystalline phases of plutonium in Some of All Fears. Good stuff.
So let's think about Tom Clancy. He doesn't keep writing the same book, but he's mining the same subject.
They're very similar, military thrillers.
In a way, his model is creating, is predicting, right? Like when he wrote The Hunt for Red October,
mm-hmm.
a lot of novels, books, right, they come from what if questions a lot of times.
Right.
People say, well, what if a super secret sub tried to defect
right.
and couldn't tell anybody right. they was
and
defecting?
And in a sense, all his novels are very similar. They're what if this very unique but catastrophic threat existed to, you know, threaten the security of the United States, what would we do? What would be our unique and unexpected response to that?
In a lot of ways, he cheats in all these books, right? He makes stuff up or yeah. Is he cheating less, right? Now, can we make a comparison that what he's doing is he's making, out of whatever his model is for predicting
mm-hmm.
these military movements or these real world, I don't even know what to call them, these thrillers, right?
Right.
Does he write these thrillers with a system that is essentially creating predictions? Can you see where I'm going with this?
I think his thrillers, his in particular, are in some ways sort of a little thought experiment to test a hypothesis. They all start with a hypothesis, and they start with very credible hypotheses that are actually based to some degree on real events or what one might speculate really goes on behind the scenes with
so
the CIA.
So in a way, they're
the
experiments.
NSA. Yeah, they are little thought experiments, which is what a simulation is. A simulation is a calculational experiment.
So far what I'm hearing is that your answer to my question is yes, we can draw a comparison.
In some ways, yeah.
Now imagine a writer like, let's say Richard Stark, who wrote all of those Parker capers. He wrote about a criminal named Parker.
Okay.
And briefly about a criminal named Grofield. We're going to ignore those.
Mm-hmm.
Just the Parker books. He wrote like 24 Parker books.
Mm-hmm.
There's a movie coming out with Jason Statham.
Okay.
Parker. And there was a movie with Mel Gibson, Payback, that was based on the first Parker book.
Oh, I saw that movie.
Okay.
So, I like that movie.
Yeah. Now,
those books ask a what if question.
They do. But also, it's the same thing over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Parker wants to have a heist. Parker has a problem. How does Parker get out of it, right?
Right.
And it's different details, but it's still the same process over and over again of creating an artwork. Do you see
okay.
what I'm saying?
Like, yeah. So here's what you're suggesting is, and this is true of computer simulation. You have a hypothesis, and you want to simulate something to see how it would work out.
Yeah, yeah.
So in a computer simulation, you start with known initial conditions that would be very reasonable, such as, you know, equal amounts of two things that are going to react.
All right, slow down, Tiger. There's something that we do have to say very carefully, because I think that one of the misunderstandings of computer simulation
yeah.
that comes from movies and comes from sort of narrative necessity
uh-huh.
You have to put into your model, you, the person,
yeah.
have to put in all the things that the computer is going to try and calculate.
A lot of assumptions, yeah.
We don't say, yeah, just put it into that computer and it'll spit out. It doesn't do any
yeah.
magic.
The predictive capability of computer simulations is as only good as the model and the initial conditions
right.
in it.
So very simply, if you had a program that you told it the temperature in the morning and in the afternoon and it told you what the temperature was going to be that night.
Okay.
The more data that you put in there, the
right.
more data points.
Yeah.
This was, you know, on this day, January 7th, blah, 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 the temperature in the morning was 40, in the afternoon was 50, and
right.
the night it was 30.
Right.
Right. It needs that data, and you need to tell it, here's what you're
yeah.
getting.
Yeah. And you don't necessarily put data into it, but what you do is you fit the data.
Oh, equations, right. You make
equations or things
that.
Like
yeah,
that. And then your equations get more detailed and more accurate to reflect what the data does. And that means your simulation is better. So garbage in, garbage out
yeah.
is a good philosophy.
And so for my stupid little example, if you start with, oh, yeah, a temperature in the morning is temperature in the afternoon, what's the temperature in the night? It's not going to help if it's raining or, you know, you're about to have a heat wave or whatever. You have more details, more things
right.
that are added to,
right.
you know, temperature.
More data, more complicated model.
Wind speed, direction,
right.
temperature the previous day, all that stuff. And you have to tell your program, you have to code your program in such a way that it uses that.
Right.
You can't,
or decide that it won't have a significant effect and ignore the right thing.
But you're still telling it what to do.
Yeah.
By not.
You're telling it
saying,
to yeah, cross that term out. Absolutely.
So
I think you're right now. I thought you were on drugs when you first suggested this, but now you are slowly convincing me here.
Do you smell that?
I do, and the difference is
Does this rag smell like chloroform?
What I do, or other people do, with a bunch of equations, Tom Clancy does with starting from an initial hypothesis and a starting point. And then he just kind of writes, and he writes, well, how would people react? What is likely to happen? His model of the way U.S. intelligence operations work is more accurate than, say, my model or probably John Updike's.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that because I've read his novels.
I think
and
Updike's dead.
Well, even when he was alive. His novels seem very realistic, which means he must do a lot of research. He must talk to a lot of military people, intelligence people. He's co-written some books with these kind of folks as well. And his technical details are actually quite good. Because he has better details, even what he speculates as fiction is—and let's face it, a simulation is fiction. You're speculating.
Right,
running it. His actually is a bit of a simulation. And if the end, provided he sticks to his model, which means stick to reasonable assumptions about what is and isn't possible by the NSA and the CIA and all these sorts of things.
Yeah. Now pull away from that a little bit more. And think less. The Tom Clancy example gives us some real hard, hard reality, hard science fiction, like, you know, the technical details.
Right.
Pull away from that and think more about, let's go all the way to the other end, poetry.
Right.
Someone who writes a poem trying to predict, say, someone's reaction to the death of a loved one, an elegy, right?
Okay.
That is doing the same thing that we were saying Clancy does.
Yeah, in some in some level, yeah.
The more times you write a particular plot, the more times that you write about people, the more times
you are simply perfecting your simulation.
Exactly.
Because we simulate over and over again and change parameters constantly.
Yeah.
And that's how models get better. And what you're saying, writing as a simulation or predictive model for the nature of people and how they act, behave, and the human condition gets better.
Sometimes the reason that we think a novel's terrible is because it's poorly written, but we love the story.
Yeah.
It's very hard to love a well-written bad story, right?
What we want, true.
What we want is for someone to kind of make the guesses. Mm-hmm. At how things work, at how people will respond, what will happen. Die Hard, possibly the best movie ever made.
And you don't like The Big Bang Theory? What is wrong with you? Die Hard with Bruce Willis?
When I say Die Hard, how does the whole movie not play out in your head? How do you not see Bruce Willis running across the glass and Hans saying, Sprechen die Frenchie. What? Shoot the glass. I mean, how is that not all in your head all at once with the Ode to Joy and You Ask for Miracles, I Give You the FBI and him leaping off the roof and the plane and the Agent Johnson?
It's a good movie. I like
it. It's so good. How do you have to ask me, is that the one with Bruce Willis? What kind of crazy person doesn't see
this from the man who doesn't like The Big Bang Theory? I mean, are you suggesting that Die Hard should be a bit of a training film for law enforcement to recognize obfuscation?
Actually, no, although that's an interesting thought. What I was going for was that Die Hard, for all its ridiculousness, it still comes down to watching a man, specifically a man, not men, watching a man deal with all the obstacles toward doing the right thing.
Right.
People don't believe him. He doesn't have shoes. He doesn't have, enough tools. Everyone is against him. He's being lied to. People are working what they think is for him but are against him. When Elliot says, I'm going to give you John McClane, he thinks that he's going to solve the situation, and it is the exact opposite of solving, right? Bruce Willis wraps a fire hose around his body and leaps off a roof and then uses a gun to get in. I mean, it's ridiculous. But the desire to not die and the way that he tries to get around all these problems that that hit him throughout the movie, I think that you could say Die Hard is about the human condition.
Yeah.
Right?
Survival instincts. Absolutely. Yeah.
I had a point, but then I got all...
But I actually think...
I got all verklempt about
Die Hard. The first one and
the
third one were about how criminals use a diversion. Right? That a good criminal... In fact, all the really good thriller movies, right? What was the one, Inside Job, where the people robbed a bank?
Inside Man.
Inside Man. And Clive they had no Owen. Intention of stealing the money. They wanted to steal something from a safety deposit box.
And they wanted to confuse everybody.
And then how do you keep from getting caught when you flee the bank? Don't flee the bank.
Spoiler alert.
I will not tell them how he did that. But the point is, this is what makes a good story, for people to think literally outside the box.
I remember my point. Yes, outside the box. And in this case with Die Hard, it is a story about human emotions, even in the midst of all these explosions and gunfire and all that.
Exactly.
This story is about the guy and what he thinks of when he's worried about his wife or ex-wife or whatever you want to call it. He's worried about saving people. He's worried about not being killed. He's, you know, he's betrayed and helped and
It's like three Shakespeare plays all in one movie. It's a comedy, it's a tragedy, and it's something in between.
John McClane, not a cop, the district attorney thinks.
So what you're pointing out is the difference between physics and metaphysics. There's the callback, meta.
Nice, nicely done.
It has been said about physics that what makes it easy is you have a laboratory. You can test things fairly directly in many cases.
Metaphysics,
there is no laboratory. All you can do is run simulations in your head. And the simulation in your head...
Or on paper, or write down a simulation.
Stories,
a painting,
movies,
right?
Prose, plays, artwork, performance art, whatever it is. And if you think about it, you do performance art out on the street corner. That gives you more of an insight into basic human nature than most things do.
I tell you, whenever...
Reality TV show is a simulation.
If
right
ever
there.
You're walking down the street and suddenly you have to change your direction or you've forgotten something, you want to turn around and you want everybody to know that you're not just a crazy person.
We all feel bad when we do
and
that.
And you like kind of slap your pockets or you
I
shake
swear,
your head.
I'm like, damn it, and I turn around. And
when you try to make it clear to everyone, I have forgotten something. And I am turning back around and going the way I came, not because I'm scared, not because I'm insane, not because I'm like a polar bear trapped in a, you know, too hot natural environment.
My iceberg is melting. Help me.
No, but because I've forgotten something. You're doing performance art.
We do. And so what I'll do is I talk to myself in my car a lot. Does that make me a bad person?
No, that's not
Sometimes I'll scream at the radio. Sometimes I'll be practicing stand-up comedy. Sometimes I'll be working out a bit. Sometimes I'll be pretending I'm being interviewed for Time Magazine's Man of the Year.
Do you stop when you're at a light so that people can't look over and look at you?
No, do you know what I do? I touch my cell phone is mounted on my dash. Now, I actually talk to my cell phone in speaker mode.
But you do something
and
to make
I listen
it clear
to
people.
I'll just tap the phone like, oh, I just hung
just
up.
Just finished the call.
I didn't. I was talking to myself. Yeah, we don't like people to know we're insane. But the truth is we all do weird things. And that's my weird habit. And I talk to myself. And, you know, if that keeps me from going over the edge, there's a great line from a movie called Blue Thunder with Roy Scheider.
About the helicopter.
Yeah.
Roddy McDowell.
Was Roddy McDowell in that one?
Isn't he the bad guy?
No, the bad guy was Malcolm McDowell. Yeah.
Wow. See, I'm definitely tired because there's
so
no way.
You never would have confused those two. Yeah. And I like
that
both
was
those
just
actors,
a name
but they're very
Roddy
different.
McDowell and Malcolm McDowell are very
And the
different.
Other one, this was one of the first films that Daniel Stern did since Breaking Away.
Yeah.
What was it? So what Roy Scheider does, and it's actually a very good thing, is he takes his stopwatch and he sets it for 60 seconds. And then he clicks the timer and then he closes his eyes to see if he can mentally gauge
Count
when it's going to hit.
Seconds, yeah.
Actually, that's a nice little test to do to see if your sense of time is right. I think that's totally reasonable. Studies have indicated that time dilation changes as you age. So it's a good thing. And one of the guys was making fun of him in this little habit of his. And he said, oh, my God, this guy checks his sanity with a stopwatch. And the captain of the precinct or whatever goes, oh, really? What do you check yours with? A dipstick? I don't even know where we were going on that one.
See, it's amazing. These movies, they play out in our head. Like, I'm remembering the last time he clicks the watch, and he's jumping out of the helicopter because he's put it in the way of the train, tractor trailer.
He's going to destroy it because no police department should have such a weapon.
Yeah, that's a little silly. Also, very silly, spoiler alert, he pulls a loop-de-loop in the helicopter. That's how he gets away. That's how he kills the bad guy.
And I would, I'll need to talk to my aerospace guys. It seems impossible for a simple reason that once you go completely inverted, the helicopter relays are pulling you down.
Yeah. And people say in the movie, no one can do a 360, not a 360, but loop-de-loop in the...
If you were at a high enough altitude, maybe.
Yeah, but not between two buildings.
No,
in
Chicago? I don't think you could do that. Well, this brings me to my point that in explaining science and technology outreach, it's always nice to find a metaphor, right? Something you can relate to illustrate a complex scientific principle.
What's a metaphor for?
Well, just either a metaphor or an analogy for the scientific principle, right? Whatever that is. I contend that most interesting and useful insights can be found in a movie somewhere. And I know that sounds cheap. And they may not be the best incarnation of that. It may not be the best metaphor, but they can be found somewhere in a movie.
I do love movies.
Yeah.
I mean, but I mean that that's an actual point that I'm trying to make. I love movies. And it seems kind of ridiculous that you would love movies, doesn't it? I mean, I love watching TV. It just doesn't sound good at all.
Oh, okay.
You know, but then
big screen,
I love
entertaining.
Movies. Yeah.
Yeah.
I imagine these things. Yeah. What David Fincher said his favorite thing about Jaws is that he never went back into the water after he watched it.
Really?
I mean, probably that's an exaggeration, but that's what he said. That was his favorite thing. That the movie scarred
so
him.
So moved him.
Yeah.
In a negative way.
Yeah.
I think after I saw a movie about another Peter Benchley novel, The Island.
Oh, not The Deep?
No, The Deep didn't bother crap. Me nearly as bad. No, yeah, The Deep. What was that? That was just an excuse to show Jacqueline Bisset? No, which one was The Deep?
Does anybody need an excuse?
Well, I don't know.
Anyway, The Island.
No, but The Island makes me never want to sail around the Caribbean on a sailboat.
How about Dead Calm? That'll keep you from
what
going
was
out.
Dead Calm?
Dead
about?
Calm is Nicole Kidman and Sam Neill are assaulted by Billy Zane in the middle of the ocean.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That was freaky. So never pick up anyone on your sailboat. Yeah, Dead Calm would do the same
if
thing.
If you're in a sailboat, you shouldn't even consider that there might be a hitchhiker. Right?
Yeah, you should carry a high-powered rifle or something. I mean, because the rules don't apply to the middle of the ocean. That's piracy. And you know what these movies are essentially about? They're about modern-day pirates in one degree.
Also, you should really never pick up Billy Zane anyway, just in general. All right, we've done a little loop-de-loop in our helicopter. We're kind of, you know, out of the...
But you've opened the book, Consilience. Well, you're about to lay it on me, dude.
I am not. I'm just looking at the fact that he has a chapter called The Arts and Their Interpretation. You know,
oh, okay.
And he says...
And this is E.O. Wilson, author of Consilience, correct?
This is our guy. The defining quality of the arts is the expression of the human condition by mood and feeling, calling into play all the senses, evoking both order and disorder. From where, then, does the ability to create art arise? Not cold logic based on fact, not God's guidance of Milton's thoughts, as the poet himself believed. Oh, I bet you that's why some Christians have a serious problem with this. That little phrase, not God's guidance of Milton's thoughts. Nor is there any evidence of a unique spark that ignites such genius as is evident in Paradise Lost. Experiments using brain imaging, for example, have failed to disclose singular neurobiological traits in musically gifted people. Instead, they show engagement of a broader area of the same parts of the brain used by those less able.
Well, I'm going to take a quote from a movie about Milton. I believe this was Donald Sutherland in Animal House. Well, to tell you the truth, I find Milton as boring as you probably find Milton. Mrs. Milton didn't like him too much either. He's long-winded, he doesn't translate into our generation, and his jokes are terrible. I don't know if that's true about Milton.
So they were obsessed. They burned within. They had also...
Burned within. There's an ointment you can use for that.
They had an intuitive grasp of inborn human nature, accurate enough to select commanding images from the mostly inferior thoughts that stream through the minds of all of us. I mean, he's trying to break down the arts into some kind of, you know, discerning critical thinking.
Yeah. You can approach the arts in a systematic fashion.
You can totally approach the arts in a systematic fashion. I think a lot of people think that art can't be approached in a systematic fashion.
They do?
I think a lot of people think that.
Like who? Jackson Pollock? Abstract artists?
Yeah.
I think Jackson Pollock is relatively systematic in his approach.
Yeah. But also, what was that quote? How do you know when a painting's finished? Well, how do you know when you're done making love?
I'm not going to go there.
I think probably he used different words for that when he wasn't being interviewed by Life magazine.
Well, yeah, because you have this, I think you just look back, okay, I'm good. I'm satisfied. I'm done. That's how you figure it out, I guess.
Oh, we've gone. Oh, this is bad. This is bad, the direction we've gone in.
No. Why? Yes. We make cheap sexual innuendo on a regular basis. Why?
Art is one of the tools for experiments in about human nature.
Yeah, so I agree. In that sense, it is a simulation. And in fact, many simulations, you run the simulation just to see. And sometimes it doesn't match reality, like art does, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't have to do a realistic depiction.
What if a couple picked up a guy floating in the middle of the ocean?
But
probably
look
the stuff
that
happened in DEADCOM wouldn't happen.
And you can still, right, even if the probability is essentially zero, you can still learn, if I do this, what happens after I do that? And if I do this, hardly ever happens. What it basically says is, good thing that never happens, because, you know, it would result in the destruction of the universe. And so to that end, my favorite sort of little piece of logic has to do with cold fusion.
Okay.
And so cold fusion, a number of years ago, Fleischmann and Pons got a little extra bit of neutrons coming out of an electrochemical reaction. I thought, well, where did this energy come from, right? Could it be that fusion's actually occurring and that's where the neutrons are coming from? In the end, it had to do with a weird temperature-dependent anomaly of their neutron detector that was actually discovered by some folks at Georgia Tech.
Isn't that a punk rock band from England?
Yes, the temperature detection anomalies of what, I don't know.
No, neutron detector.
Is it neutron detector?
That's okay. What you just said, though.
I don't know. Is it a punk rock band? I can't, what am I?
Shouldn't
what am
be?
I? A polymath? I'm going to.
A polymath?
Is that what you say? A polymath? That sounds like something you got to register for a national database for. Sorry, ma'am, I'm a polymath. You can't be within 30 yards of my house.
Hold for edit.
Why? That's not so bad.
No, this is bad. But I do feel like I'm not able to finish any of my thoughts.
Neither am I. And you just cut me off. What was I talking about? I had a
neutron detectors. Cold fusion.
Oh, cold fusion.
They found that there were more neutrons coming out of this.
So basically what they concluded is that, you know, fusion, right, which is the combination of two smaller nuclei into a larger nuclei, which has a big barrier, but when you do that combination, you get a lot of energy out. If that happens spontaneously, if the barrier in some cases wasn't as big as we thought, you just have crap blowing up in the universe. That's my speculation.
Isn't that happening?
Well,
Isn't crap blowing up in the universe?
Yeah, but we understand why it blows up, and it's not due to cold fusion. It's due to very hot fusion. So when you have a supernova, any small child can understand the basic principles. The balance of two forces, gravity and the kinetic energy of this fusion furnace, is what determines red giants and supernova and things like that. And it's like blowing up a balloon. It's relatively simple. So when people say, maybe through their art, that, you know, the world will end with the second coming of Jesus or some God coming down from on high, no, it won't. It will end in a 2 billion years, something like that. We don't know exactly what it is, but it's approximately a few billion years when the sun goes through the red giant phase, and it will.
But isn't that knowledge also what drives people to write about, say, God coming down or God's coming up? There's how long until you can completely ruin a movie, do you think? Like how long does it?
What the hell are you talking about?
I mean, if a movie's been out for a year, can you just kind of ruin it? Can you just say,
just wail on it? You mean just criticize?
No.
Oh, make a sequel that's really bad? Is that what you mean?
What? No, you're completely missing my point. I was going to completely ruin Cabin in the Woods.
Oh, with a spoiler.
Yeah, but I'm going to not. I'm going to shake that off and suggest that you see Cabin in the Woods if you're listening, because it's awesome.
I have not seen that. I think that's on cable TV.
Well, I'm so glad I didn't ruin it for you. It's great. I love it.
I don't like those scary movies. They give me nightmares. You won't go back in the cabin in the woods again, just like Jaws.
You would enjoy what they do. Anyway, so H.P. Lovecraft, for instance, wrote about the Elder Gods coming back and tearing the earth asunder and eating everyone's souls and just, like, you know, destroying the world.
What the hell did we do to deserve that? This is about global warming.
We didn't do anything. That's the point. They would just come back. I mean, we were their playthings. They care about us as we care about ants.
So we're an ant farm.
And we're not even an ant farm. We're a mound that's grown up in their lawn. And when they get over there, they're just going to wreck us. So, don't you think?
Don't if it's you fire think, ants, I will wreck it. I will admit that.
Dr. Ludovice.
See.
Don't you think that in our core, we kind of know that everything's going to eventually end in fire? And so we have that feeling of it's all going to end in a great apocalypse. And that's why we write these stories about things ending in a great apocalypse.
Well, you're right. Whether you're religious or not, you believe there is some coming, some reckoning.
Don't you think? I mean,
whether it's the red giant phase of our sun or
death, just death. Don't you think that? I mean, like
God. Well, yeah,
our death, own death. We then extrapolate as soon as we start realizing, oh, well, I'm actually on a rock flying through the universe, and the sun's going to swell up and ruin.
Right.
And
so don't worry about it too much and have another beer.
Yeah. You start really thinking, oh, well, how does everything disappearing actually feel? And then you write these stories, or you consume these stories, one or the other, mm-hmm. you know, to get it out of your head or to articulate it in your head of the end of everything.
Well, is that why we're fascinated with stories about the afterlife and
no, I think
the
that's because we fear death.
Well, who doesn't fear death? I hate the, well, he just fears death. You can fear death in an inappropriate way.
I'd like to talk to you about this. We have about 9 minutes left.
But we all fear death.
I don't fear death. And this is what I don't fear. I'm a little bit like Woody Allen. I don't fear death, but I certainly don't want to be there when it happens. I fear, you know, screaming hysteria and horror leading up to my death.
Okay, I don't so you'd like to go quickly.
Well, yeah.
And yeah, I would too.
I don't want to fall into a pit of snakes, you know.
I
don't want to be attacked by something that, you know, savages me and then die. You know, so I fear pain and I fear terror.
Well, that's normal. Everybody fears that.
But I don't fear death. I don't fear the absence of myself from the world. I don't fear the disappearance of my consciousness. I think some people
I don't fear that because there's really nothing I can do about that. I fear that happening prematurely. I think there are still things I'd like to see and experience. But past 80, that's borrowed time for me, man.
I love my life. I love my wife. I love my kid. I love, I love this life that I'm living.
Especially this podcast right here.
But I don't fear it suddenly ending because I figure that I won't know that it's gone. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When I wink out,
yeah,
I'm cool with that, just that happening. I don't fear that.
But what if it happened tomorrow? You're right. I don't fear it. I would regret it if I couldn't squeeze, you know, another few
decades. If someone said you got 24 hours, I'd probably lose my mind. That would be really strange.
It would be, but I'd party like there's nobody's. There's no tomorrow.
I'd try heroin. I've never done that. I'd like to know what that's like. Anyway, so you know.
Okay.
Once we
just a little, though, so it didn't consume the entire 24
hours. Well, like,
hours.
You know, if I had that last hour, I'd want to do that last hour on a serious nod. Yeah.
Okay.
So we know that we die.
Okay.
And for a little while before we really know that we die, mm-hmm. I think we really get into apocalypses.
Okay.
We really get into the idea that, you know, the whole world will go screaming with me. You know?
Right. Eventually.
Once you get past that, I think that you can ease back, and then you're less hip to, you know, natural disaster or end of the world movies, because I'd like everybody to keep going even after I'm gone. I want people to have more. I'm good with that.
Okay. I don't know what you're trying to say here.
We were talking about apocalypse narratives and fear of death. And then you got all bent out of shape.
I think you got pretty squirrely on me there.
You don't like it when people say that someone's afraid of death? Because you think everyone's afraid of death.
Well, to some degree, well, you're right. If you go quickly and suddenly, you know, say a nuclear weapon explodes above Atlanta, there won't be time to figure out what's going on.
Before we even, like, if right now.
I want to be right in the epicenter when that happens.
Boom, CDC.
I don't want to be,
that's why we're in Atlanta.
I don't want to be 100 miles away and die slowly from radiation poison.
No, that would be terrible. And I definitely don't want to live out the road.
And I don't want to go so long that I'm sitting there in a diaper drooling out the side of my face going, I'm turned into, who's the guy from Saturday Night Live? Dana Carvey's grumpy old mate. Well, in my day, I don't want to be like that. But I want to go, there's a balance. I want to go far enough so that I can experience new and interesting things. But the day that you have to go to the bathroom by remote control, it's time to... You know, I think I'm going to take up skydiving when I'm 80 and just not worry about it.
So I think we're fascinated with the end of the world stories because we're doing models of our own.
What if? All these apocalypse movies are what if.
But even more so, models of our own decay.
So speak for yourself.
No, seriously. I think that when the story is the whole world disappearing or dying, what we're doing is we're doing an extreme predictive model of how we would feel about our own death.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Yeah?
I'll give you that.
You good with that?
Right. But it's a common experience. Everyone wants to explore that.
Here, I want you to look at this Mayan calendar.
Well, actually, there are other Mayan calendars, versions of it, that have nothing to do with 2012.
People were very happy, though, to have something to... focus all of their
really
we're all gonna die attention. Did you not notice last year that people were really into the whole idea?
Yeah, but those people are just silly.
Those people are probably everyone who listens to us.
I don't think so. That doesn't mean I didn't like the special effects in the movie 2012.
You might not have liked the story, but
the movie was a little bit hokey, but the special effects at the beginning, way cool.
Pete, what have we learned today?
I think we've learned that art is a simulation in the metaphysical realm, just like computer models and other computer simulations are sort of a predictive model in the physical realm.
Yeah.
So actually what you're saying is even though we're geeks, we should be looking at art as some sort of reflection of what we think or hope or wonder will and does happen in that metaphysical realm. And the truth is, any good scientist, I think, has some connection to this EQ thing as well, that we're still humans, that we still have some of those human characteristics as much as we like to dampen them out, like some of the characters on The Big Bang Theory, which you do not like, and I don't understand why you don't like it. Are the jokes too geeky for you?
Oh.
But you're a geek. My God, you've got a degree in economics and society, technology, and culture, and a master's degree in library science. A master's degree in library science.
Library and information science.
Okay. You of all people should be able to relate to some of the geek jokes. For example, a recent first
You can say whatever
Big
you
Bang
want.
Theory.
You know I'm just going to cut this out at the end.
No, that's okay. don't cut this out. These are gems dripping from my lips. Consilience with Pete and Charlie is a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
Recorded at the WREK studios on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology.
And do our opinions reflect those of Georgia Tech or WREK?
I don't think so.